There's a fundamental distinction between bad and good is a handy thing. Okay. I noticed that Anant has a t-shirt that has a road sign to Houghton. It says, Houghton 4 miles, end of earth 2 miles. It's a nice thing about giving a sequence of talks in a place that's reasonably remote. You know, the audience size just doesn't fall off like it would in San Francisco or Las Vegas, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, it'll probably show up in a couple of minutes. That's our technology. Okay. I want to talk about a method that's actually kind of a complicated method and sort of a method of last resort. But even if you don't apply the method, it's sometimes a useful way to think about problems and could lead to a little bit deeper understanding of what you're interested in. And so I tend to call this the objective method, and we'll talk about whether that's a good name or not. I want to motivate the method in the case of a problem like the ones we've been looking at. The idea of the thing is that you have to invent an object, some infinite dimension, infinite object. And so one of the puzzles is how you find these objects. So I want to talk about some of the process for searching for one. Then we need some technical information about topology for nice sets, and then I'll give you some information about an infinite spanning tree. And then we'll tie all the pieces together and prove a theorem. Now I mention the central limit theory for the types of functionals we've been interested in, particularly central limit, the possibilities of central limit theorems for the TSP and MST, and for some easier problems like the sum of the nearest neighbor lengths. And in contrast to parts 1 through 6, this technique for conditioning method for independence is really very easy and solves lots of problems. In particular, it solves some problems which have been done in the literature by very hard methods. So it really is a technique which, in less than one page, one can do results sometimes that have been done in published articles of length 35 pages. So it's a nice trick to have at one's disposal. If nothing else, is to keep you from writing up that 35-pager and then finding the one-pager at the end. Okay. Now, we saw before from the space-filling curve method that if you drop a billion points at random in the unit square and you form the minimum spanning tree and you look at the sum of the squares of the edge lengths, then that sum is less than 4. Okay? Choose 4 as a symbol for B. 4 is more forceful than B. Okay. Actually, I think it is. And for the MST in 2 dimensions, we can actually take B to be 4. Now, Bob Bland, long before that fact was known, Bob Bland had been studying some algorithms for the MST, and he'd been generating his MSTs at random. And to save taking square roots and measuring his distances, which he was looking at large problems, and square roots are actually an expensive operation, he would just look at the trees he got by minimizing the sum of the squares of the edge lengths. And since the greedy algorithm works for the minimum spanning tree, whether you look at lengths or squared lengths, doesn't matter. You get the same trees in any case. And the thing that Bob observed was, damn, you see, no matter what algorithm he used, that didn't bother him, but no matter what sample he used, he seemed to get the same value for the MST. That looked kind of looked like a bug. But eventually he checked things and was led to the conjecture that if you take the minimum spanning tree in 2 dimensions and you look at the sum of the squares of the edge lengths, then that converges to a constant. Okay. Now, I got interested in that, and using the sort of subadditive methods that we've been talking about in the earlier parts of the lectures, I was able to prove that if you look at the sum of the alpha powers, then you have asymptotics to a constant n to the 2 minus alpha on 2. And this was true for all alpha between 0 and 2, but I couldn't get to 2. See, in the case of 2, this exponent will become zero, and I'd have the Bland conjecture. So there it stood for quite a while. So we know that something's bounded. We know that we have the limit theory for all of the alpha powers up to 2, and yet the limit theorem in the case of 2 was just a little bit out of reach. Well, this is where David Aldous, another good name for this method is Aldous's method, and he may be the only person who can actually make it work, but everybody can think about it, everybody can do a piece of it, but David may be the only person on the planet that can actually push it all the way through. Here's the idea. You begin with a problem, and the problem is to determine the asymptotics of some feature of a sequence of objects as n goes to infinity, i.e. you want to determine the behavior of f of O sub n as n goes to infinity. So for instance, in our case, the objects could be minimum spanning trees on a sample of size n, and the feature could be the length or the sum of the lengths of the alpha powers of the edges, or the number of degrees, or the number of times that you would make a cycle if you added an epsilon ball, or, you know, invent 1,000 functionals, and that's the idea. Now, the approach involves the idea of inventing an infinite object, some infinite object that's that you can think of as the limit. I put these things in quotes like this. When I was a graduate student, I was at Stanford, and I rode my bicycle past a fish place every day, and on the sign of the fish place, it's fresh fish. So, you know, I thought they sort of really wanted to italicize it rather than put it in quotes, because to me, fresh means not quite fresh if it's in quotes. And of course, this limit means not quite a naive limit. Since it's in quotes, you have to think about what that limit means. But in an appropriate sense, which you have to sometimes work hard to define, you have the objects converging to some infinite object, and you have to have some sort of continuity of your functional, and then conclude that the functional applied to the finite object goes to the functional applied to the infinite object. Now, this still won't buy you anything unless your infinite object is somehow natural, approachable, useful, has some sort of independence or other nice properties. So there has to be some sort of elegance in your infinite object or you're still busted. Now, actually everybody knows wonderful examples of this paradigm, and that's where the finite objects are the initial segments of a random walk, and where the infinite object is Brownian motion. In which case, this objective method just becomes a theory of weak convergence. Now, imagine explaining to somebody whether you work on the objective method or on weak convergence. I think the choice is simple. You know, everybody would rather work on the objective method, right? But in some sense, you could say, it's just a variant of the theory of weak convergence. But I think it's worth a distinction because in the theory of weak convergence, we've got a technology. We know about tightness. We know about convergence on cylinder sets. And we sort of have a dance that we know how to do. Whereas even to begin the dance, in the case of the objective method, sort of the hard part. You have to invent the limit object. Okay. So obviously, in our case, for the minimum spanning tree, the most natural object to think about would be the Poisson process, the minimal spanning tree for the Poisson process. So let's think about constructing the minimum spanning tree for the Poisson process. Well, one algorithm is we'll find the two closest points. Well, oops, for the Poisson process and the plane, you can always find two points that were within epsilon for any epsilon. So there are no two closest points. So that idea of beginning a minimum spanning tree algorithm won't work. Another idea is to say, okay, well, pick some point and start growing the tree from there and just keep growing and it'll cover all the points, I'm pretty sure. Well, you know, how do you know it doesn't drift off to the right? No way to know that it's going to span. So those two natural ideas don't work, although they come pretty close. And now here's a a variant on that that looks like it's not going to work but does turn out to work. For each of the points, take the infinite tree that you get by growing the tree from that point. Okay. Now, I'm going to take E to be an edge of my graph. If E is either in the tree beginning, so E is equal to x1, x2, I'll take that to be in my graph. If E is either in the tree beginning at x1 or in the tree beginning at x2. Okay. Now, that's my candidate for a minimum spanning tree of the Poisson process. Now, that needs some justification. Okay, two pieces of justification. One is a little lemma to prove to the notes. You have to show that this thing doesn't, we haven't somehow walked into a cycle here, so that this graph is cycle free. Every point is joined with an edge, so in some sense this is a spanning graph, so it's a spanning acyclic graph. And a spanning acyclic graph is at least a forest. So this does give us a forest, an honest forest for the Poisson process. And you know, if you have a forest that's honestly defined and you sort of think that in your heart of hearts you really do believe it's a tree, we're working in dimension 2, so we really believe it's a tree, maybe we don't even have to prove it's a tree. We can still use this infinite object and achieve that program outlined by the objective method. Maybe you can still prove those limit results even without proving that this thing is a tree. It's just an object. Okay. Well, one has to collect some facts. I mentioned before that G is a forest. Now we're going to focus on a particular tree, and so we instead of looking at the Poisson process, zero has a little bit of a special role. So we'll add zero to the Poisson process, and that gives us what's called the Palm process, or you just think of it as the Poisson process plus the zero. Now here's a theorem. Let Sn be the set of endpoints which are in the unit square, and let those be IID uniform, the distributed on the unit square. Look at the sum of the edges in the MST of that sample and add up the squares. Then this theorem asserts that that converges to a limit L in LP for all P. Actually, in the paper we just did it for L2, but in the notes I give a little bit of a change in one of the inequalities and goose it up to LP. And there's an interpretation of that length, LI. There's a normalization that I'm worried about here. I'm worried about a normalization. Now, look, theorem 3 looks right, but I'm still worried about a normalization. But let me explain the constant. What is the value of this limit constant? The nice thing is, if you've got an infinite object, you can sometimes identify what should be the limit. Now, we're interested in the sum of the squares of the edges that are incident to 0. Let's just look at 0 in the infinite tree and look at the edges that are incident to that. A minimum spanning tree in dimension 2 can't have more than 6 edges, and with probability 1 in the random model won't have more than 5. So that's a nice finite sum. Now, a typical point really shows up on every edge two ways, so you have to do some correct counting, but it turns out that you can identify this limit L as one half the sum of the expected values of the squares of the lengths over the points which are incident to zero. So we actually not only have a limit, we have a kind of an identification of the limit. This idea of limit constants in these theorems is kind of interesting. We certainly know a constant if we say prove the constant is 2 divided by 1 plus the square root of 2. That's a constant we understand. Now there are other constants where we just show that an object which we obtain by the limit is identifiable as some, say, geometrical object. You know, the length of some boundary or the length of something, which nothing's changing. We've removed the dynamics, so the object is a fixed object, but we don't quite know the numerical value of that fixed object. That's actually a sense in which Bertzimus was able to prove the value. You find the value of the constant in the minimum spanning tree. Okay. Now here's a little bit even easier fact, but typical of the other facts that one can read out of this. Okay. So if d is equal to the degree of 0, the degree can be 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, then, and this is in the infinite tree, here's a nice example of the fact that the infinite object can sometimes be simple. The expected value of the degree is 2. It's kind of a nice fact. And it's actually kind of obvious. I'll prove that in a second. But here's something a little bit better. If you take 1 over n times the expected cardinality of over all of the n sample of the degree of the point in the MST, and that frequency of vertices, which come out to be a value I, don't need the E there. So it's just the frequency of the cardinalities. I could do the expectation, but let's do the frequency of the cardinalities. Frequency of the cardinalities, that's the number of vertices of degree, say, 3, that converges to the probability that 0 will have degree 3 in the infinite object. So it's working just exactly like you'd think it would. Whatever analogous question, for instance, if we didn't write this down, but let's look at the percentages of edges, one vertex of which has degree 2 and the other vertex of which has degree 3. Okay. That has some frequency in any finite minimum spanning tree. You'd be pretty hard-pressed without a general tool even to show that frequency existed, that is, that limit existed. But in the infinite object, there's certainly some probability of that event, and we can identify the probability of that event as the limit from the finite object. Okay. All right. Now, why is the expected value? Let me talk through why the expected value of the degree is 2. Okay. You've got an infinite. First of all, let's think about a tree of any sort. How many edges are in a tree?
One fewer than the vertices.
Yeah, that's right. N minus 1 is the number of edges, and so the sum of the degrees is equal to twice that, so we got 2 times n minus 1 is equal to the sum of the degrees, and we had n vertices, so if we divide that by n, then we see that the average degree is just a little bit off from 2 in a finite tree. So in an infinite tree, you figure it's got to be exactly 2. Okay, well that's a long way from a proof, but if you sit down and work on that idea and draw yourself some boxes, that's exactly how you go about proving that theorem, and that is proved in detail in the notes. Now, the method's technical. You have to sit down and think about what do you mean by convergence of finite sets, and that means, among other things, you have to think about nice sets. These are sets, say, which wouldn't have any limit points in a finite box. They draw a finite box, there'd be a finite number of them in that box, and therefore no collection points. And if you have such sets, then what you mean by convergence is that there's some way to order the set that's converging so that you have point-wise convergence of the reordered points. have to talk about convergence of graphs, so that means you have to invent some rule about edges. There are a number of different choices that you can make there, but there are some natural ones. Then, what you need is that this existence of this graph object has got to have some pleasant properties, and it turns out that a type of semi-continuity is about the best one can do, which can be expressed in terms of the degrees. And with that expression for continuity, then it boils down to just a degree condition. I mean, this is pretty technical stuff, but I just want to give you a flavor for what's there. You have to get a degree, a condition on the degrees, which actually gives you genuine convergence of the graphs. Okay, now that's a lot of discussion of that technology, but the theorem is written down there in the notes, and I'd hope that someone will give it a careful read. There's one lemma I'd like to bring to everybody's attention. And improving what, you know, is analogous to tightness, we have a lemma 5.3. I want to draw a little picture for that. Oh, I don't think I brought my little German pens today. I did. Suppose you have two points. They determine an edge. Now, if I draw, suppose this has radius r. If I draw the ball of radius r that has center x, and I draw the ball of radius r that has center y, I get a region which is called a lens. And once I've got that and it's centered about that point, I can shrink that a bit to get smaller lenses and think about, say, just shrinking it by a factor of a tenth. A better constant's in the paper. Okay. Now, take the minimum span tree, form all the lenses, shrink those lenses to one-tenth their size, and the theorem is that those are disjoint. Now, that provides us something kind of nice, because the area of that lens is proportional to the square of the distance between x and y. And you've got all these lenses that are disjoint, and they live essentially inside the unit square. So that says the sum of the areas is bounded by 1, so that gives you a uniform bound on the sum of the squares of the edge lengths. Okay, so that's a fact that we proved earlier using space-filling curves, and this is a way to prove the corresponding thing using a direct geometry. Okay, so that's one of the fun technical bits that shows up in the context of that. Okay. Now let's think a little bit about central limit theory. Even in Beerwood, Halton, and Hammersley, they in 1959, they mentioned the possibility of a central limit theorem for the traveling salesman problem. That has not been proved. That's you know, if you want a single salient, outstanding problem. Everyone who's thought about any aspect of this subject at some point has turned his mind to the idea of, is there a central limit theorem for the traveling salesman problem? And no one has anything in that direction. So that's quite an important and interesting problem. Now, the minimum spanning tree is a lot more tractable, and that's certainly a natural place to start looking for a theory, and yet it's still quite hard. And almost simultaneously, Ken Alexander, Harry Keston, and Mr. Lee, whose first name, Sung Cho. Mr. Lee approved a central limit theorem, so I want to describe those. Alexander's was in dimension d equal 2, and it was for the Poissonized TSP, and he proved just exactly what you'd expect. That is, that if you pull off the mean, divide by the variance, and you have convergence to the normal 0, 1. Okay. Now, there are some limitations to this. I mean, it was remarkable good news. But there's still some limitations, one of which is that it's still just the Poissonized version, and it looked difficult to depoissonize that. Okay. Also, it's a dimension 2 result, and the technology was such that it looked difficult to extend it beyond dimension 2. And it looked like it was sort of the limit of the technology which was provided there. The paper did articulate a type of relative independence of one region to another region. There's no doubt other stuff that could be extracted from it, but there it sits. Now, Keston and Lee proved in general dimension for general power weights that one has the unpoissonized center limit theorem, that is, you have convergence to a normal law with a non-trivial variance, and you have a standardization not by an unknown constant, but by a fixed function of n. So this is, the power's wrong there. That power would be wrong, it would be right for alpha equal to 1. But we'd have to fix this. Can you tell me in real time? If I just make that, I think it's also wrong as I wrote it down in my paper, but I think we might have to replace. This is true for all values of 2 equal to alpha plus 1. Okay. But the bottom line is it's a fixed function of n. Okay. So that accomplished the depoissonization. It gives power weighted edges, works in general dimension. So what's left in that? There are no rates, and it looks real hard to get rates. A thing that might not be as hard, but would probably be quite worth doing, even if it's technical, is to push on to general distributions. Also, it would be interesting, I think, to look at some other functionals using that technology. In particular, you might consider things like sums of degrees over fixed regions. That's one functional that I thought would be interesting. Now, to give you an idea of some of the this is too hard. Both of these theorems are too hard to do in these lectures, but I can give you some idea of the technology. By looking at an earlier result of Avram and Bertzimus, which in the proof of which I give in the notes, I take advantage of some of the ideas from Keston and Lee to patch a few little holes in the Avram Bertzimus proof. Okay, so here's a simple theorem. Look at the sum of the nearest neighbor links. This is an easier functional than we've been looking at, but it certainly still is a subadditive Euclidean functional. Notice that this isn't a matching. I mean, we've got two joined here, but that guy's it's neck and neck, but that guy's the closest neighbor to this guy. That guy's certainly the closest neighbor to that guy. And you can have other little chains. Now, you don't expect too many very long chains. A question which I don't know the answer to is, what's the asymptotics of the length of the longest chain in terms of the longest number of points which are nearest neighbors to each other? It'd be kind of a fun thing to look at. Now, it turns out that this type of problem exhibits a very clear form of a local independence, which is conceivably present in some of these other problems, but very hard to articulate in these other problems. Okay. So the function we're interested in is the sum of all of the lengths of the links. That's not an easy one to say. I probably should have chosen some other word other than links, or else I should drug in those little mean cats, the L-Y-N-X's. Okay? They're very mean little cats. Okay, so let's look at a simple box here. So I've got a box, and in this box I've imposed a special property. And the special property is the green dots. I've made sure that there exists at least one point in every box. Okay. Now let's consider a red point up here, a circled red point. And let's look at the nearest neighbor of that. I claim that since every box has a point, that the nearest neighbor of the circle point has to be in the red box. Now, it doesn't have to, for instance, let's suppose that this point was right here, and this green point was way down here, and that this other point was way over here. So the nearest neighbor of the circled point doesn't have to be in an adjacent box, but it can't be more than one box away. Okay. Now, not only can it not be more than one box away, but now consider changing any of these points out here in the blue region. Has absolutely no influence on the length of the nearest neighbor length to the circle point. No influence at all, zero. Change it any way you like, no change on that length. That has to do with this somewhat special nature of this problem, but that's the way it is. So you can change the points in the blue region however you will, and the cost of serving that special red point will not change. Well, that gives us a type of genuine independence. So even if I just had 16 boxes like this, and I dropped down a Poisson sample, if I condition on each of the 16 squares containing at least one point, then the sum of the links necessary to serve this box is independent of the locations of all the points in the blue region. Okay. Now, that wouldn't be very good. You couldn't go very far with just that 16 box, but if you see if you expand it out, that's going to buy you something. Okay, so that's a key idea. And there are a number of functionals for which analogous arguments do work. I'll give you a little list of them. All right, dependency graph. So consider a set X, calligraphic X slash cal X. Backslash. Backslash cal X, which is equal to a set of random variables, which will index by the vertices of a graph. Okay? So now I call capital G a dependency graph for script X if the sigma fields generated by all of the variables whose vertex is in A versus all the variables whose vertex is in B are independent, provided there's no edge between the A set and the B set. Okay? That's what I mean by a dependency graph. It's a very useful notion, and occurred in and the history of that graph is It goes back quite a bit. The first place that I saw it actually appears in the papers of Lovaas and Erdős on the local lemma, 1975. So it goes back a bit further than where Avram and Bertzimus trace it, and it may go back prior to Lovaas, but that's certainly one place which predates a location in the Russian literature cited by Avram and Bertzimus. Okay. Now, here's a version of Stein's. It's just actually just a careful writing down and the working out of the conditions of Stein's dependent, D-dependent, central limit theorem from, if you know, Charles Stein's book on approximate calculation of expectations. And it's a theorem that's somewhat of Barycine type. And it says if you have a bunch of random variables with a dependency graph dependent upon n, and you look at the sum of the random variables over the whole vertex set, and you look at the CDF of the normalized random variables, then the difference between that that CDF and the cumulative normal is bounded by a constant. It's an ugly little constant. Call it 100. It's about 100. Okay. Cardinality of V to the half times the maximum degree of any vertex in the dependency graph times a power, and the power is a bound on the size of the random variables divided by the variance of Sn. Okay. Now you got to get all your orders of magnitude balance for this to be useful, but that can certainly be done. Okay, so that's Stein's inequality. And let's look at how this plays out in the case of the nearest neighbor links. So let P be the given probability measure, so that's the Poisson process on the plane. And I introduce P hat, that's a Poisson sample of size n in the unit square. I introduce a new probability measure, and this is kind of an interesting thing for me. As a child, Spitzer convinced me that working with conditional expectations was a dangerous thing, best not done. Okay, so I've tended to avoid working with conditional expectations through most of my professional life, and I've missed a few things because of that. And now, this is actually sort of not really a conditional probability, as probabilists, fully adult probabilists, think about conditional probabilities, but it's a new probability measure. Which, in terms of elementary probability, is the conditional probability, given that the event A sub n occurs, that every one of the m cubes contains a sample of our finite sample. So I break the square into subsquares. So the size of the subsquare is of order square root of log n on n. And back to this phrase of Erdős, every baby knows that if you drop n balls into a number of boxes such that each box has probability about log n on n, then with high probability every box will get a ball. So if you take the areas of those to be log n on n, then with high probability the event an occurs. So we're in the domain that the Baldy-Renot theorem applies. We let L of Cij be the length of that part of the nearest neighbor graph that falls in Cij. Okay. Now, you have to lean on it a little bit, but by that type of argument that I gave before, you can see that if you're several boxes away, you're going to be genuinely independent. So these random variables are going to be have bounded degree of the dependency of those random variables. And when you work that through, you get the following result. that this normalized sum is equal to the cumulative normal plus an error, and in the notes I work it out to get big O of n to the minus a half plus epsilon. Avram and Bertzimus don't have a plus epsilon there, they have a logarithmic term, but since, you know, everyone believes in his heart of hearts that you can probably beat that exponent perhaps quite considerably, no reason to worry about the log term. Now there is one real bottleneck in this, and that the Stein D-dependent central limit theorem does not give the characteristic behavior of 1 on square root of n that one expects from the Bariassine theorem. And to beat that result of Stein's would have a lot of implications for a lot of results, but still it'd be interesting to see how far you can push this down just facing the constraint of Stein's theorem. Okay. Now some remarks. The change from the p measure to the p hat measure actually requires some aspects of patience and the careful working out of the variances under p hat. But it's, you know, it's nothing that anyone can't do if he just sits down and is a bit persistent. Now, if we look at the sum of the squares of the edges of the minimum spanning tree, we've given two arguments so far that show that that's almost surely bounded independently of n, the space-filling curve bound and the lens bound. But that doesn't happen in all of our favorite problems. In particular, for the TSP, the best bound you can get is constant log n. Okay, there's actually an example that shows that the sums of the dth powers of the edges can be bigger than epsilon times log n. The other fact is that right now, for the problem of showing that the sums of the dth powers of the edges converge, one could also use the Redmond-Yukich rooted dual technique. So the objective method is not really critical for that application anymore. I don't know if maybe somebody could think it through. I don't know if you can get the corresponding results on the degree by that result. So the degree of the theorem would be useful that way. But the degrees were handled independently in the earlier paper by Shep and Eddie and myself. So one can get the degrees by direct sort of subadditive thinking. And in fact, the degree result is true for random variables with any distribution, any non-singular distribution. No compact support, any density, etc. So one has limits of the degrees, but not the identification of the values. Also, in the notes, the proof of the Avram-Bertzimus result has been modified to reflect some of the observations in Keston and Lee. And I hope in the course of patching some things that look like mistakes, I didn't introduce other things that look like mistakes. So I hope somebody will give that a careful reading before I have to ship it off to the bindery. All right. Well, that's...
juggling.
Oh, God, yes, juggling, yes. Yes, we have to have our juggling today. Now, let's review. Tray plane, single ball, two balls. You're going to throw the ball out of your weaker hand, in my case it's the left hand because I'm right-handed, when the first ball reaches the apex. And the next step, wish it was a more elaborate step for this, you now have three balls, but you're not going to take any bold action. You're just going to keep this ball in this hand. You're going to throw this ball up here. When this ball reaches the apex, you're going to throw this ball and keep this ball in his hand. And then after you've done that a few times, then you just juggle. No, we'll do them later. Yes, I'm going to put these in the notes.
Could the book have like three balls to it too?
This book by Siam will be the first book to come bundled with the juggling balls. Actually, somebody recently wrote an article in the Monthly on the mathematics of juggling, when he talked about the various patterns that are possible for juggling. All right, well, we ran quickly today, but I don't think that's going to kill us. We can run more lengthily at other times. Or else, we can. Anybody have any general questions of any sort about what we've been doing?
That's not the most terrifying one.
I think it's a good time to...